Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Conservationists Assembled podcast, the show that seeks to unite Earth's mightiest advocates in a mission to ensure a future for our planet's incredible habitats and its awesome inhabitants. I am your host, Johnny Bloxham, and today's episode is all about one of Europe's most endangered species and perhaps its most endangered mammal, the European mink. Join the podcast and today's expert guest as we discuss everything about the European mink, including what they are, their threats, and the successes of rewilding them. And on the note of our expert guest, we've got Teet Moran joining the ranks of the Conservationist Assemble initiative to shed his lifetime of knowledge and experience on European mink conservation. Let's give warm welcome to Teet as he takes us on this journey. Teet, thank you for joining us on the podcast today. How's it going?
Thank you. It's busy time, like always, during weekdays, but it's going well because, you know, it's Friday when we are doing the recording. So it's nice to think that you have at least 3 days less meetings like usual working days. So it's nice. And weather is nice outside also, at least here in Estonia and in Tallinn. It's kind of feeling of spring outside.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, certainly a motivating feeling when that first weather starts to change and you know that the nature that's going to come with it as well. So have you got any plans for your weekend after we finish recording?
I have some obligations which I have to do, but I definitely try to escape also from city just to get away from my previous job and to feel the nature, to feel the environment which is around us, because, you know, in a city you kind of start to forget what is the environment, what we have around, and understanding also that we are part of this environment.
Oh, what a great retreat to be able to have.
Yeah.
So we're here today to talk about the European mink, which is a species that you've got quite the involvement in. So the logical place to start is could you just tell us about the European mink and its history and why we're talking about them today?
So we have to say that we have to have a couple of lessons or lectures here, 2 hours long. We can't do it, so have to be brief anyway. But the species which we are talking, it's not completely wrong to say that it's endemic to Europe. It has been outside over the Ural Mountains a little bit, but basically a very short extension. So basically we are talking about a species which should be European pride, so it has to be kept alive. And the second thing, of course, ecologically, it's a species which is living between water and the land. So we call it semi-aquatic mammal, semi-aquatic carnivore. And I really like the kind of slogan which was used long time ago by National Geographic when they made a small story about European minks, that thinking about mink, think of running water. So basically, that's this carnivore which is living in a running water environments, riparian areas, in small forest streams, and totally depends upon this biotope and the food resources which are available from that. And nowadays, of course, the problem is that the species is basically disappeared from the range, what it has before. It could be found only in Spain, and the most recent estimates are saying that the population in Spain is around 150, in contrast to what it was thought just a year ago, approximately 500. And the number of in France is basically unknown, but let's say maybe 100 or even less. And then we have the population in Romania, in Danube Delta. We don't know how large it is, but probably less than 1,000. Something in Ukraine, and something still left in Russia. And then we have in Estonia the island population in Hiiumaa Island, which is human-made established population in the island. And what is basically really a funny fact is that we have also a population of European mink very far away from Europe, actually very close to Japan, in Kuril Archipelago in the island, which is called Itrup, and it's also human-made. By a Russian scientist, researcher, long time ago, Dmitry Ternovsky. But the thing is that it's critically endangered, one of the most endangered small carnivores in the world, definitely the most endangered mammal in Europe. And because of that, we really have to pay attention to that, both in terms of being active in a zoo community, maintaining captive population, and trying to find the ways how to use the possibilities of what the zoo community has actually to bring the species back into the acceptable conditions in the wild, and also using this kind of operations to try to explain to the public what is a conservation, why we are doing it, and why it's important to do it, and why the environment for us is actually really existential need that we keep it like it is, not only for ourselves, but also to other species, because in the long term, keeping it like it should be for other species also means that we are keeping it for ourselves.
That's a great kind of introduction into why we're talking about them, and kind of really alarming to hear that population in Spain has had such a dramatic decline in such a short period of time. So,
sorry, I'm just interrupting it. That's not so much a decline, but you know, sometimes scientists, if they are doing research, say all of a sudden if I'm using different kind of research, and that is providing completely different kind of picture. And that's exactly one case when they were using a kind of different way to look onto the population. All of a sudden, the optimistic estimations that they have approximately 500 mink in the wild was just overestimation.
Right. Okay. So it's to do with the way we're assessing the populations, and not that necessarily the individuals were ever there. All right. Great. Thank you for clearing up. So, like you said, they are a semi-aquatic carnivore, and they help by conserving European mink, and their habitat would help conserve other species. So, what kind of role do the mink play in their wider ecosystem?
That's a funny question. It's usually people are asking, what is the purpose of one of the other species in the biotope? Let me put it another way and ask from you, what's the purpose of humans in the biosphere? Can you reply to that question? So I think the question by itself is irrelevant. If the species is in place, it's just a part of the ecosystem. And that's how we have to take it. But trying to find a purpose or a role of a species in the ecosystem, it's kind of anthropocentric approach to try to understand how the biosphere is functioning. At the same time, we know so little about the biosphere and its components. So it's just not impossible. You could say, what is the purpose of something in your household? That's an easy one. And even then, sometimes it's really not very easy to reply to this kind of question, but to try to explain why one or another species existing in the biosphere, it's just underestimation of the complexity of the biosphere. We can't reply to this one. But then again, let me put it another way. If you look from the human perspective, we could say that the European mink is a guardian or a steward of small streams of rivers. So it's indication that if the small streams and rivers are suitable for the European mink to live, that also means that it's suitable for a really large amount of different kind of different life forms. So from our own cultural perspective, we could say that it's a kind of indication that part of the environment, what we have around, is actually in a healthy condition. So maybe this one is a better explanation to your question.
Yeah, so it's apt to say that they're an indicator of a healthy environment, for sure.
Yeah.
So, well, what is the classification for the population of European mink? And I know you mentioned that the one in the Korean archipelago are classified as critically endangered, but for the European continent of population, What are their trends and what's their classification?
You mean classifications in terms of IUCN, or what you
Yes.
mean? In IUCN, it's right now regarded to be critically endangered species, and it's valid estimation for sure. New estimations are assessment is just underway, and it will confirm it for sure. Country-wise, the decline. Let's say it was really widely dispersed from the central part of Finland until the Black Sea, and then from Ural Mountains to the south. We actually don't know how long time or how far to the say to the west it was spreading. I'm coming to that issue quite soon. So it was basically distributed everywhere. Except we don't have data about the presence of mink in Sweden, so possibly it was just not moving over the Botnia Bay to the Scandinavian Peninsula. Not also evidence from Belgium and from the Netherlands, although there is not logic why it was not present in these two countries long time ago. We just do not have data about it. And finally, it seems that the data in France and in Spain is relatively recent, and it has been declining in France, and right now it can be found only in the very western edge of the country. And what is interesting in Spain, that in Spain it was first discovered in 1950s last century. So it seems really that it was actually extending its range over the Pyrenees Mountains to the Iberian Peninsula, and was forming a small population, which sometimes is making people to say that it's a foreign species in Spain, which of course is not true because it was naturally just spreading its range. And from this kind of and also in Balkans, it's there is not enough data, also not in Italy. But we could say that it was basically spread all over the Europe. And then because of the change of the in landscapes, like improving the so-called improving of the rivers, dredging of the rivers, and melioration actions, the species started to decline. And what actually happened, and which was the main cause of really a fast decline, was at the beginning of last century when the American mink became a fashion animal and a fur animal. And because it was a lot of business profit related to the fur farming of the American mink, it was brought into the Europe. In the Russian part of the range, it was really introduced to the wild in a very large number. I think the number was around 40,000. Just to make the population American mink in the mainland. But the main culprit of the decline was actually the mink farming. Because if you have a mink farming place, you can't have a mink farm without escapees. And if you're doing in a regular basis, let's say 10 animals every year, it's a perfect way to get the feral species around. And if it's around the farm, it is starting to spread. The same happened in Estonia, same have happened in Poland, in basically all countries. And that's also the main concern, because definitely there are still left good streams which could be suitable for the European mink in the mainland. But the thing is how to get rid of the American mink. First, eradication by itself is possible, but it's really an effort. But at the same time, there is also business interest in still in a mink farming. So, on a political level, it's not very easy to make even acceptance. And secondly, getting rid of the American minks in the continent just by eradication, it's incredibly expensive. And then, if you look where you put on your in your conservation money, one could ask, is it really a valid way to use the relatively short money which is available for the conservation in general in Europe?
Yeah, perfect point there. So, Obviously, yeah, the American mink were brought over. Were European mink ever used as part of the fur trade?
When there are two interesting points. One is interesting from culture point and historical point, and the second is interesting from a biological point. First, when I started to work on the European mink, I was really interested to find out what was the value of the mink, European mink fur in Russia. I'm speaking in Russian language, so the Russian literature is available for me. And to be honest, it was really astonishing for me that the European mink was almost never used by noble people in the costumes. The most common fur which was used was sable, of course, and hermine, the stilt fur. And then I was also looking the price list at the beginning of 20th century, and the price of the polecat and the European mink pelt was basically the same. So what basically means is that if you look back into the history hundreds of years ago, European mink was not, valued by people who could afford to have a fur around like a garment. But it became fashionable with the American mink fur farming. And now we think, just because the American mink fur is regarded to be valuable, that's the American mink fur. That's European mink, historically, the fur has also been valuable all the time, and that's simply not true. And the second point is that definitely when the mink farming started, there were attempts also to keep European mink in farms, and that always failed. And the reason for that, I can't say it, in for full knowing that it's true, but it seemed to be that the reason for that is that the American mink is way more social than the European mink, which means that it's way better species for fur farming, where the minks are very close to each other. And the European mink is more solitary, and being very close to each other is just causing too much stress for the animal to tolerate the horrible conditions in the mink farming.
Oh, so that's very interesting. That's never really been a threat to them then. So in terms of American mink escaping, the farms that they were kept at, what is the detrimental impact of that population now on the status of European mink?
First, I would like to say that actually hunting started to be a problem also for the European mink when the American mink started to be, luxury fur, because at that time nobody was made actually different. That's two different species. They were regarded to be the same species but different subspecies. And because of that, the hunting pressure actually was remarkable in the former Russia, also in Finland and Eastern European countries. The question was, sorry, I forgot your question.
No,
Can you
that's
repeat?
great. So, yeah, what effect did the escaped population of American mink have on European mink?
What actually happens is there are two layers of impact. First layer, of course, is that at least in the northern part of Europe, there is a shortage of resources during wintertime. And because of the American mink is way more flexible in using different kind of habitats, it's more efficient in surviving. And the second thing is that reproductively, the litter size of the American mink is larger. It's becoming into the heat much earlier. And it has, this kind of delayed implantation, which could change. It could be 30 days and it could be 90 days. So it's flexible, and that will make it more flexible carnivore in the habitat he's living. At the same time, the European mink is fixed gestation time, and it's living very, very close to the water in small streams and rivers, not going far away. It's less social, and it all, you know, sums up that if these two species are getting together, the superior one, and it's also larger, the American mink, the superior one will be the American mink. And there are quite a bit of some articles, pretty good articles, about the direct aggression between two mink species in Belarus, and two good articles also in Spain, which are, one is showing how the American mink is just chasing the European mink away from the suitable habitats, and the European mink is ending up in suboptimal conditions, and of course living in suboptimal conditions is decreasing the survival chances for the animals.
Fantastic. So in terms of then conservation efforts, what are zoos doing, or what have zoos been doing for a long time to ensure conservation?
For me, there are always three basic things for zoos, and that is what I've been standing for all the time. Because it's such a critical species, you really have to maintain in the captive population. It's definitely not, you know, such kind of fantastic, sexy zoo species, but visitors really like it because it's very easy to hide, and it's not presenting it to the visitors so easily. It's more like a luck to see the mink in the display in a zoo. So it's not a good visitor animal. But at the same time, keeping a population, which we collectively can do, is making what you call it warranty population. So we could use it actually to start to make new wild populations in places when it seems to be reasonable to do it, in terms of that the population established in a wild could actually survive. The second thing, that's 2 points, the warranty population and establishing into the wild a new population. The third one, I think the zoos are in a perfect position in spreading messages, conservation messages. And this kind of actions, when you are doing something practical, intensive work, captive breeding, release of the animals, monitoring the success, it's actually catching human eye, and people would like to see, and say they start to be interested in the thing. And by using these projects, explaining the need of conservation, what we have done to the wild, that could be the third one. We could use this kind of projects just to explain for the patients the need to take care of different kind of life forms, other than human life forms, and to make them also to work in our societies, to have a stronger support to the conservation actions.
And so off of the back of you know, establishing that captive population and pairing up with maybe in situ organisations, what kind of success stories have come out of European mink in zoos?
I think the main thing is actually what is being done in Estonia in Tallinn Zoo. It has a long history. We have been involved in Tallinn Zoo. Actually, I'm not working in Tallinn Zoo, but I'm still identifying myself through the zoo and the mink project. It was starting for me in the year was 1982. So you could say that it's quite a bit of time, basically a lifetime, to be involved in one project. It's not even a project, it's a program. It's kind of long-term action. What we achieved actually is that right now in Tallinn Zoo we have a special breeding facility for the mink, which is keeping 100 minks. The capacity of the facility is 100 right now. And there is also a DNA lab, so we can make research on the DNA, we can make research on feeding and stuff. We have two, three people are working on a research part. And we also coordinate all European program, EP program on the European mink. And the year was 1998, when we started the operation in the Hiiumaa Island, which is the second largest island in Estonia, 1,000 square kilometers, to make an island population. So the population which is safe from the American mink and which could have at least a small population of the European mink in island conditions. It has been really a long exercise, starting from basically from scratch and a huge learning curve. Sometimes I'm calling almost like, you know, this American, what you call in this parks, American...
roller coaster.
Yeah, something like that. Up and down all the time, frustrations, optimistic feelings and frustrations again. But the result is that actually we managed to have sustaining population in the island for 2017. And we released the minks in the island 16 years before that. Learning a lot about the ecology of the species and about the release technique as well. And what is also important that this kind of knowledge which was achieved by the work both in a zoo and also in the wild, it was possible to give the innovation further on to Spain and to France, a little bit also to Romania and even to Germany. And the other people have been starting to work on the very same issues also in the other countries. So it's kind of, you know, you start in one spot and then, you know, the same idea is actually catching people's interests and even government's interests, and they try to do the very same thing, or of course slightly modifying because, you know, countries' conditions are different. But the basic idea is how to do it also in other countries. And what is also important is that you can show that, yes, we can do it. It's not something which is completely impossible. It's not easy, but it's possible to do.
So what were some of the key kind of elements or aspects involved in kind of setting up that program, from kind of, you know, getting the green light to use the island as a hub for reintroduction to kind of the stable population that is there now?
About the stability of the population, let's come to that a bit later. But, you know, you have to understand that Estonia was part of the former Soviet Union and we gained independence early 90s. And at the time when we started the project, you know, the new legislation was in a kind of period of establishing, just creating a new pieces of legislation. The media was different. The administration was at the very beginning, and it wasn't a very rigid system. So in a way, that was time when you had a lot of possibilities to do something incredibly flexible way. So you didn't need to have a huge amount of making a management plans and reports and asking permissions. It was incredibly simple. If I'm just trying to put the very same kind of things into the modern times like we have, I would say it's almost impossible to do the project like SAI nowadays, because we have so many restrictions and needs for permit and provisional studies and monitors, and we are basically drowning in preparation, and finally we find out that it's so incredibly expensive that we can't do it. But that was really a lucky time when it was possible to start this project. And secondly, what was really the main concern, what we had, actually two concerns with the island, was that there was American mink population, which was originating from local fur farm. So before starting it, we actually had to eradicate the American mink. And you know, eradication or a killing of a species or a large, relatively large number of animals could catch a lot of media attention. So when we started it, and at the beginning, actually, I had very strongly involved in Oxford University with Wild Crew and with David MacDonald. Actually, a lot of funding was coming at that time from the Darwinian Initiative. It's important to mention, but also from quite a bit of different small SWU private foundations which were providing funding to do it. We were thinking how to actually explain to the people that we are killing a lot of American minks. And we decided that we have to be transparent. We have to explain what we are doing. But at the same time, we have to be very clear why we are doing it. So, you know, there is interesting things. In one side, you have kind of individual ethics, killing of individual. At the same time, you have the species conservation ethics. If you are not doing it, you are not making it possible for another species to survive. And we always used this kind of argument when we were talking in the media, and media actually paid a lot of attention to that. And we had only one negative article in the news. Nowadays, again, it could be way more complicated because media is just so much more complicated and controversial than it was times ago.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And I think obviously modern conservation would also agree that honesty is the best policy and that, yeah, there's always going to be some pushback, but that is the importance of the education, you know, messages that zoos and other conservation organisations are providing to try and change that attitude. And you know, there's a lot of hard work to be done. And you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. You know, you've got to take certain steps back to move forward.
Yeah.
So you mentioned briefly in one of your previous points that government aid was vital in kind of the other countries that have mink populations in adopting the methods that have been done in Estonia. So what kind of government aid can assist with you know, the European mink story?
If you have in mind the actions which were done in Estonia, we actually started all the ex situ was basically done by the zoo, and then we had the support which was coming through Wild Crew in Oxford, and the money was actually coming from the Darwinian Initiative for 6 years, which was really kind of very much needed support, otherwise the project wouldn't have kicked off at all. And then we used also EU Life for one time, for 3 years. We had a project, and that was also part of the project to start release, actually continue releasing the Hiiumaa Island. Later on, we tried, I think, 3 or 4 times to get additional project funding, but we failed. And then we decided that it's starting to be too formal and it's too much effort to try to get money. But a lot of money was actually, funding was coming from zoo community private foundations, from Netherlands, from Austria, from Finland. I have to be careful that I'm not forgetting the most important ones, but basically in so many different kind of, in Germany for sure. And I have to say that some of these fundings were really critical, because if you are running a project like that, you're constantly fighting with lack of funding. And sometimes, you know, the lack is just critical. If you are not getting the funding in a short time, you can't continue anymore. You have to stop the work. And then all of a sudden, some of the zoo community persons or a foundation on zoos were just giving a funding, even without asking any kind of paperwork. They kind of trusted what we were doing. And only later on, we explained what we are doing and how we are doing. And for instance, if you're doing a life project, you have to have a self-funding part and you have to have the breach funding. If you don't have the funding, bridge funding, which you have in a sign, then you can't do it. And some of the zoos in Netherlands for to just provide us for that time quite remarkable fundings, just on a basis of honestly, not on a basis of making a huge long contracts and stuff. And later on, the money, once we had got from the EULife money, like the end fund, transfer of funds, we could just pay it back. So a lot of things actually was coming from a zoo community. And that's also one way how the zoo community could act. It's not only doing, you know, the actions themselves in the field, but just supporting what the other people are doing. What is also important, and that is nowadays also starting to be a discussion in the zoo communities, and what I really felt and I can really emphasize the importance, is that there's a long-term funding. With a short-term funding, you always, you know, have in this kind of stress situation. You don't know, you have funding for this year, but what happens to the next year or a year after that? But if you have even, you know, some base funding, which is continuous year after year, let's say 5 years, you know, you could be more rational in what you are doing, and it's less stressful in running the conservation project.
Yeah, I think it's certainly important to highlight that aside from being a place where a lot of people can go and see species that they certainly might not ever see, but also more importantly, the stronghold of endangered species, that there is that important financial element that now for a lot of modern good zoos is a legal requirement, that they're legally obliged to donate funds to conservation projects yearly. But also they don't just do it because it's a legal requirement, they do it because they understand the importance and they want to donate those funds.
What is important is in the EASA standards right now is that the zoos just have to do in situ conservation. They have to have a conservation plan, strategic plan, and they can do it by involvement in something which is in the wild, or they could just provide funding to something. And that's really important. I know that a lot of zoos have been reluctant to that, but in the long term, if the zoos have to survive, they have to do something like that. Otherwise, the public attitude against the zoos will grow, because we are regarded to keep something in captivity. The zoos, the animals, the captivity issue is interesting issue in how we understand captivity, but we have to show that what we are doing, that's really important. And it's not showing what we are doing, but we actually have to do important things in the wild as well.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that to light. I think, yeah, it's important to shed the light on the continuous legislations, like you say, that zoos do have to abide to, and it will ultimately force zoos' hands for the better in the long run.
Yeah.
So how can people who aren't necessarily working in conservation help support European mink conservation?
It depends. It depends. That actually brings me to another interesting issue, is, and it's my own learning curve, is that when we started to work in European mink conservation, we always were thinking that we are working, you know, the individual minks, the animals, and we are releasing, and that's a species or a population of which we are working. But what we actually started to realize, and it's even silly to think that how we thought at that time, is that if we are working with a species, we are not actually working only with a species. The species is just like a gateway to much wider issues, because none of the species cannot survive in a wild without relations to the wild. So we actually work with the whole landscape, the biotopes, and because the biotopes also have impact from humans, we also work with the humans. So, you know, the working with a mink is just a starting point to the much, much wider picture, to realize the wholeness of the world and the people ruled in that. And if you ask how the people can actually support the mink work, it depends on where. The most simple reply would be, of course, try to fund and to help. And that's valid. It's one way to do it. But there are other ways to do it also. So depending on the country, if people are living in Spain, they have to try to support all the actions to maintain the running water, to get the contamination away from the running water. The way, how far we are in the running water, how much we try to get something out from the running water, how the agriculture is functioning around the running waters. And the running water is actually everywhere. We are kind of underestimating the importance of small streams of rivers. They are kind of, you know, small blood vessels in our bodies. We do not know them, but without that, the large rivers do not function as they have to function. So that could be one possibility also. Or you could just try to support conservation even more wider way, or to advocate to different kind of living of humans. So we are not consuming so much, to consume as little as possible. So, you know, it's funny, you could start to work on small mink, but at the end of the day, you're actually looking the whole biosphere and the relations between human being and the biosphere. The simplest way, of course, there is no research project and conservation project which doesn't need funding, for sure. People who would like to support the mink project in Hiiumaa Island and Tallinn Zoo, you have Foundation Lutrola, very happy to have support. You will find it in the Facebook, the data about the foundation and possibilities to support. But then there's the wider possibilities, the both ways. You people can do it.
That's incredibly insightful to know that, yeah, even if you were purely focused on helping mink by process, you help the wider population of biodiversity, and yeah, hopefully plenty for listeners to take away from that. So I wanted to focus on your career and your background now. You've given us a great insight into the project and the history of mink. So when did you first know that you were going to get involved in conservation and specifically with the European mink?
It's back to the Soviet time. And it's almost like going back to different kind of universe. And I think the people who are listening, it's not very easy to understand how the society was working on that time, unless they were actually the listeners from former Soviet Union, then they do understand of my age. But basically what happened, I was in university studying biology. And at that time, the system was working in the way that when you were graduated from university, you were forced to go to work at least 3 years to the post the government decided that you should work. And the most common place was actually to be a teacher in a countryside school, which nobody wanted to go. I have to say myself as well. Nowadays, I have completely different kind of attitude for teaching, of course. And then I was going to the to Tallinn Zoo director, Matti Kaalo, that time, in the old place. What is actually funny is the administration building of Tallinn Zoo was actually the old Peter's the first sauna in a park which is called Catherine Park, according to the wife of Peter the first. And I was saying that yes, I would like to go to work into the zoo because I don't want to be a teacher, blah 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 blah. And he was looking through the windows into the distance and said, if you want to work in a zoo, you have to be a little bit crazy. So I've been working in a zoo for 40 years, so I've probably been sufficiently crazy in this position. But the crazy was in a positive sense, not in a negative sense. And what actually was, then I heard first time the story of European mink. And that was because of Matti Kaalo, the former director, had really very...
intense relations, not intense is not the right word, but you know, a lot of relations to the researchers of former Russia in St. Petersburg or Leningrad, like the last former name, and in Moscow. And he learned about the problem. The problem was totally forgotten in Western Europe. Nobody knew it because, you know, the mink was basically the American mink. European mink disappeared so long time in most of the countries. People even did not realize that they had a species like that, like in Germany, for instance. But in Russia in 1970s, actually in the Russian literature, it was an issue. It was a lot of discussion in research, scientific literature of that time. And he brought the issue to the country and wanted Zoo to do something. And then it just happened that it was a perfect combination. He knew the issue and I came into the play. And he was saying that, yeah, please, you could do it. And so it happened that after the end of the university, I was starting to work like a researcher in Tallinn Zoo. That was 83. Again, a long time ago, and my whole career of working has been, you know, the red line or the middle line has always been the European mink.
And so then, now, you know, fast forward, you are still tied to Tallinn Zoo, you're still associated, but you're no longer working there. So what is your current role and what does a typical day look like for you?
Right now, I'm in as a member of parliament in Estonia. Actually, the first full year, I'm with Social Democrats, and it was a lot of thinking a year ago. I was already in a position of Tallinn Zoo director for 6 years. I felt that I'm exhausted. And I'm not doing the things what I have to do. You know, it's strange feeling that you know you have to do something which is not pleasant, and just because it's not pleasant, you are not doing it. And if this kind of feeling is starting to be more and more, I had a feeling that I have to leave, just because it's not going away. It's going only worse and worse, and it means that somebody have to take over. At the same time, the issue of a forest in Estonia and conservation, we don't have a Green Party, and we didn't have anybody in a parliament with ecological education or understanding of the conservation issues. Then I was playing with the idea that maybe I should try to run for the parliament, that maybe it's possible to have a position. I was discussing with some people and they said, oh, you have a chance because, you know, usually the director of a zoos are pretty well known, and especially in a country like in Estonia, where Tallinn Zoo is basically the only zoo, you end up in TV basically 1-2 times in a week. That's a minimum. And that means that people really do know you and your actions and things. And then I decided, it wasn't an easy decision because, you know, people don't like politicians. Sometimes there are reasons for that, but not always. And I decided, okay, I'm trying to do it. And then I was just taking a campaign and I ended up in a parliament. And what I'm doing nowadays, I'm sitting in the Commission of Environment and also the Commission about the European Union affairs, which is, let's say, at least 35% is actually related to the environmental issues because of the Green Deal and the things. It's very tense. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of listening people and talking with people. But it's at the same time is rewarding in a way that if you have not been in the parliament, you don't know how the power is working. And I have to say that I've been extremely simple-minded before. once you are inside of the power works and you really understand how you work, and you also have better understanding what is possible and what is not possible. I have to say that I have been relatively naive in the earlier time. A lot of things I really know how complicated it is to change. And some of the things you have to just admit that you can't do anything. And the second thing about that the people don't like politicians, you know, it's funny. There is a label, there is a word, politicians, and people don't like this label. At the same time, this label means a lot of very different kind of people doing different kind of things. But, you know, these ones are which are the most cursed in the media will actually make the people attitudes to the politicians. But actually, there's a lot of people which are really hardworking people, politicians trying to do something to help the people to get easier livings and also working for the environmental issues. So maybe it's important to understand that we are not living in the world of labels. There are, you know, different things in behind those labels, and it sometimes merits a deeper insight to understand how the systems are functioning. But it's not an easy job, that's I have to say it for sure.
Yeah, some really real talk there, and I think it's crucial to highlight the importance of mental well-being, and then certainly from I suppose from your perspective of you know leaving an industry which you love and passionate about, because like you said, you were exhausted, and certainly something that we see within conservation, unfortunately, now quite a bit. To now off the back of it find another angle that you can still contribute to that passion is incredibly encouraging.
Also, I was not mentioning the other kind of reason why I was doing it. And that was because when I was working with the mink, I was haunted all the time with the issue that we are fighting with the fire. We are like the fire brigade who is trying to get away or get rid of the fire. We have to try to get the animals, species back to the environment to protect the communities, plant, or let's say, different kind of nature communities. We try to protect the rivers and the coastal meadows and forests. But at the same time, and we succeed, we sometimes really have a success. You know, the Hiiumaa is actually in 2017-18, it has been success. We managed to make a sustainable population. And what I'm calling it nowadays, it's a short-term success. At the same time, if you look how our societies are functioning and how much we go into the environment in all possible ways, we always talk about development, which means we have to change something which is natural to something which is human-made. The likelihood that the short-term success will last for a long time is not very long-lasting. And that was making me also think that if you are really working for the mink, you have to work in the wider scale as well. And that's also something which I think everybody working in a conservation, like I told, I think before already, that it's not only working with species, it's working in much, much wider scale as well.
So what then gives you motivation to keep going, and what influences did you have, you know, on your career?
What you mean influences in my career?
Yeah, who influenced you to kind of go down the biological route or kind of get involved with conservation? Where did that
I think I didn't have any choice. I didn't have any choice in my biological career because my grandma was the director of an Museum of Natural History in Tallinn, and my father was a nature film movie maker. So I basically grew up with nature and talks about nature around me all the time. So I have never had any hesitation. I always knew that I will be one or another way related to something which is in nature. What has influenced me for sure, wandering around with the movie crew in different parts of Estonia and also in more former Soviet Union. Then, of course, being around in a former Estonia, in mountains, in deserts, everywhere. If there was something good in Russia or a former Soviet Union, it was a huge. So you had a lot of huge, fantastic possibilities to be in a wilderness. Secondly, I think I've been in terms of mink, I had really impact when I had a chance to go to Black-footed Ferret recovery team in Laramie in Wyoming, and to learn how the Americans were working. It was kind of a wow effect for me, what is actually possible to do. What else? In wider scale, maybe books. A lot of books reading about the, to try to understand. What I'm always saying is that if you have a questions and it seems that you do not find replies to the questions what you are trained to understand in universities, then you have to dig into the books and you have to read and read and to try to seek the answers. So the books are kind of mentors which could teach you a lot. And like always, you know, the disciple of the mentor, it had to leave from the mentor to get to the next one. So I've been reading a lot of books about nature, about the different cultures, especially traditional cultures and the relations between the ecosystem and traditional cultures and how we are have ended up to be like we are in our typical Western society. A lot of books about anthropology. And that has helped me to understand, at least I hope, the attitude of present human being and the environment and the problems. It's a lot of philosophical issues, but I think we do not dig too deep into these ones. And from that perspective, you know, if you say who have been giving me the strongest impact, I think I even made an article in Estonian language, which was entitled "The Disciple of the European Mink." So my greatest teacher has been actually the European mink, working with the European mink.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of conservationists would credit animals being a big influence and a big teacher to what they're achieving and accomplishing. So, conversely then, have there been any hurdles that you've had to face in your career?
For sure. Practical things, a lot of practical things which are related to the funding. What is always annoying is the bureaucratical frameworks in which you have to act nowadays. I do understand why it is needed. And, you know, it's interesting thing is that, you know, the regulations, what we are doing, it's because of something is doing bad. But who is punished is actually these guys which are doing good, because they have more restrictions and more complications to achieve the positive goals they want to achieve. So maybe this one. In European mink work, which has been always irritating, is if there are some kind of restrictions from general legal framework, but once European mink, let's say in local community, is a highlight of kind of symbol of conservation mink, everybody is relating to these restrictions to the European mink. And then it's a lot of explaining to explain that, guys, you know, that's not a problem. It's not because of the European mink, but because of the general framework, which sometimes is just stupid. And that's one of the things. I don't know how it's in other countries, but I feel that the same is that the conservation ideas are so far away in the capitals, in the cities, and not so close to the local communities, which makes it way more complicated to explain for the local people why it is done. So the conservation, which must be actually part of the way the local communities are functioning, the local people are feeling that they don't want to hear it. It's kind of alienation from the government. And it's really a bad thing what happens. And I think it's not only here in Estonia, but it's basically in every country. Up to the level that sometimes people are saying, well, I really like nature and I want to preserve it, but I don't want to have anything to do with the government because that's usually bringing me only problems. And that's not a good way.
And then, you know, what advice would you give to people who are looking to pursue a career in conservation?
Emotionally, I think conservation is providing a lot. And I'm again a little bit philosophical, but you know, we are living in a kind of interesting society with a lot of mental problems in people. And one of the gravest issues which the young people very often are having is this very central question: why you are existing? What's your purpose? And it might seem to be maybe too large or you know, too philosophical, but the question, who am I, is really an important question. You know, the life, you cannot be only consuming to have a new electronics or a new mobile phone, or for a short while it seems to be that it's really important that you have, you know, special costumes or a fantastic fancy car or whatever. But in one day you have a feeling that it's not enough. You have to have a different kind of purpose. And this different kind of purpose you could actually achieve if you define it yourself, that you could live for something what is a greater good, and conservation, take care of different kind of life forms, is actually you are taking care of much wider goods than just your own personal me. And maybe something like that is what conservation is actually providing to you. Of course, life is not, you are not getting very healthy for sure, and you have a lot of frustrations, but the feeling that you are something worse off, that's definitely worthwhile if you are considering the career like the conservationist.
Yeah, and with that, you've given us a great insight into what makes you tick and where you got today in your career. So to finish up the episode, we're just going to have some quick fire, light-hearted questions about what you enjoy most in life. So, Teet, are there any species that you'd love to see in the wild?
I would like to see all the species, but it's simply not possible because sometimes we do not even know what is a species. It's, you know, the human definition of the life forms. That's why I'm not using so much word of species, but mostly life forms. I'm very much intrigued in fungi in recent times, just because they have such a remarkable role in this biosphere. But if you're asking about the species which are more us-like or human-like, closer to us, like mammals or the birds, I'm not talking about fungi or a bacteria or something like that, then maybe I would be interested to see, for instance, giant otter, because that's a remarkable species for sure. And Maybe it's because, you know, the animal of the year in Tallinn this year is otter, and I've been just doing quite a bit of talks to the people about the otters and also the different otter species in the world. And it's interesting species. It could be one which could be really interesting to have a look at or to feel, you know, this kind of life form. What else? Yeah, it's the same, like, what species you like the most? I have always complications to reply to this question. I like them all.
Yeah. No, absolutely valid answer. And I suppose, you know, a lot of what we've seen and what we've talked about in terms of how we can help the mink can also be transferred to otters also. Certainly, you know, again, when we talk about European otters, so I can understand the link there. How about places on the planet? Is there anywhere you'd particularly like to visit more than anywhere else?
I was last year actually in Nepal, in mountains, not far from Annapurna, of course not so high. Annapurna is more than 8,000, we were 4,000 something only. I really like the places where the people have, you know, this kind of traditional lifestyle. But at the same time, I've traveled quite a lot. But in the recent years, I'm a little bit hesitating for two reasons. First is the impact what I have if I'm traveling. So I have a good feeling that if I know that something is left somewhere, I don't have to go to the place because then I'm creating, you know, tourism and the impact. That's one of the concerns. And secondly, what I found that actually you could find in your own country so many different kind of things. Estonia is a small country, you know, it's 45,000 square kilometers. I've been traveling around those countries quite a bit, and I know so little about the country. It's always possible to find something new, and sometimes it's good to use the very same trodden trails you have been before, because then you can see the change. And, you know, the change sometimes helps you to understand the very local area you're living in. So I'm actually failing to say you in which kind of places I take, though. Culturally wise, of course, I would be interested to go to South America, because the cultures which are in the old Indian cultures before Columbus, it's really interesting, it's very fascinating, and it's also so widely misinterpreted in nowadays mainstream understanding about the old traditional cultures. Maybe this way.
Fantastic. And how can our listeners follow your work?
That's complicated. It's easy. You have to learn Estonian language, which is one of the most complicated languages in the world. And I have a blog, titmaran.ee, but it's only in Estonian language, in which I'm trying to collect all my articles. But one possibility is I'm always happy to talk.
And lastly, then, what is the one thing specific to European mink that you think our listeners should take away from today's episode?
I think it's in the beginning. If you think about mink, think about running water.
Perfect. So, T, a massive shout out to you for gracing the podcast of your knowledge and efforts in European mink conservation. We'll be sure to keep up with everything in their developments in the future, and we will hopefully speak to you again soon.
Yeah, thank you, it was a nice talk.
And with that, our time on this episode of the Conservationist Assemble has come to an end. A massive thank you to Teet for his hard work spanning over 40 years and his time on the podcast today, but also a huge thank you to all of you for tuning in as always. If you did enjoy this episode, please like, share and review or rate the podcast, as it helps us to keep improving and spreading the word on the conservation efforts taking place around the world. Don't forget that you can always follow and interact with the podcast on Instagram, Facebook or via email. I've been your host, Johnny Bloxham. I hope to see you all next time, and remember, the Earth is what we all have in common.